Ridiculous History is a production of iHeartRadio.
Welcome to the show, Ridiculous Historians. As always, thank you so much for tuning in. Quick disclaimer at the top. We are a family show, but there are some parts of this story that are a little, shall we say, racy? What do you think?
A little salacious, perhaps?
A lingering touch, maybe a little too long on the cheek.
A little too familiar. It's true. Those Romans knew how to party, let me tell you.
Yes. Oh, and I'm Ben.
Oh, and I'm Noel. And I will tell you, we will in fact tell you together along with super producer Casey Pegram.
Are we talking like Ridiculous History After Dark right now? What's going on today, guys?
Yeah, big time. This is like the Red Shoe Diaries of Ridiculous History.
Awesome. So we got David Duchovny on a beach about to read one of our letters. Okay.
Yeah, it's true, folks. Before we get into today's episode, you might be wondering, hey, guys, why did you decide to do something a little more risque today? And that's because we are, you know, we're dead set on ruining our reputation. We just got famous. We got a write-up in Vanity Fair that I initially thought described us as three famous shipwrecks because I just skimmed over it. And shout out to everybody who wrote in and let us know that. It was very kind. It must have been a slow news day at that publication of note. But we appreciate it, and we thank everybody who's affiliated with our show in this episode. But of course, thank you again. I don't know. So it felt like maybe our next logical step, now that we've reached the heights of of something.
I mean, no better time than getting a little minute notoriety than to torpedo your whole career with a single episode and a single fell swoop. But also regarding that Vanity Fair write-up, also shout out to Dressed, the History of Fashion, which also made that list of 10 history podcasts to check out. And honestly, there were some on that list that I was not familiar with, and I look forward to checking out myself.
Yes, 100% agreed and well said. So you might be wondering, how are these guys going to ruin their show for us today? Well, we're going to ask for some help from the ancients, from Rome. We are going to ask for some help from a guy named Emperor Tiberius. Now, in these are days of reality television, being, you know, a deranged shipwreck of debauchery is a legitimate business, and a lot of people do very well with it. But this guy was putting in the work way before cable. You know, we don't get to use this word too often in modern English, but this guy's debauched. He is debauched.
He is twisted, debauched, a bit of a prevert. Definitely exhibited some kinky behavior as a human being. Also, you know, one in a long line of Roman emperors who were just not particularly great people.
Yeah.
Spoiler alert there. He preceded directly Caligula, one of our favorite debauched emperors, but he came by that honestly. He had a pretty great role model in the debauchery department. Tiberius was born on November 16th in 42 BCE on an area called the Palatine Hill. He was the son of Tiberius Claudius Nero, who was a Roman Caestor? How do you say this word, Ben? Q-U-A-E-S-T-O-R. I know praetor. I don't know caestor. Is it keister, perhaps? That would be appropriate.
Yeah, that's it's kind of like a money man or a comptroller. This is a general term for officials who had some sort of hand in or agency over public revenue and expenditure. So it's a good job if you can get it. This guy's full name, by the way, Tiberius Caesar Divi Augusti Filius Augustus. So you can see why they called him, you know, Tiberius, or maybe Tybo, or Big T for short.
Wait, he had an Augusti and an Augustus? Why? Well, that's a weird flex.
Double Augustine, man. You know, in the days before television, people had much longer names. So, and also he's royalty.
Absolutely. Ben, it's really funny. I grew up in a town called Augusta, which is, you know, where the Masters golf tournament takes place, and also where James Brown was born, and he lived nearby until he passed away. But it's funny, every time I've met people not from Georgia, they always pronounce Augusta, Augusta. And I've always been kind of blown away by that, because I'm like, have you not heard of Augustus? Like, it seems like a weird stretch to assume that you, and it's a hard aw sound. So just putting that out there as a little bit of a weird anachronism from folks not from from my neck of the woods.
Yeah, like pronouncing Nevada or Nevada. That's a good example of that. I remember I was in Ireland one time. And this cab driver, who is a beautiful, shady dude, I want to write a story about him. He was like, you know, where, I'm not going to do the accent because we're on air, but he's like, where are you all from? And, you know, we said Atlanta, Georgia. And he goes, oh, yeah, why? And I had never had somebody ask me why I lived, like, why am I from there? And then he said, you know, I would never travel to Georgia except if James Brown was still alive. Because that's the thing about me. I'm Irish. I love James Brown and I love the Rolling Stones. And that's the only reason I would go to your state. But James Brown is dead. Anyway, here's your hotel. That was literally how he talked.
Yeah, people love some JB. It's funny. There was a stand-up routine that Chris Rock did when he was performing in Augusta, and he referred to it, referencing the Masters and James Brown, as the whitest and blackest place in America. So I thought that was pretty clever. But back to ancient Rome.
Yes.
As we know, Julius Caesar, you know, got stabbed to death. Mm-hmm. Pretty brutally by the entire Roman Senate. They all had to have a hand in that, so it could be like a quorum of murder.
So weird. Like, why did they name a salad after the guy? I think we should be calling all knives Caesars now.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And after this event, Rome was absolutely in disarray. There were these factions that emerged, Mark Antony on the side of Caesar, like, you know, trying to I guess defend his honor or whatever. And Tiberius's family fought alongside Mark Antony. But then Octavian, you guys might remember, Ben, I'm not sure if you watched this, but Rome on HBO, all of this was dramatized pretty beautifully. Not entirely sure how historically accurately, but it's a really fun show. But Octavian was a character you kind of grew up with because he was sort of a boy king. It turned in his favor, and then Tiberius and his family were essentially forced to flee, and they did that thing to Sicily. And that's when Octavian named himself Caesar Augustus, and he became the first legitimate, last, I don't know if legitimate is the right word, but the first in name emperor of Rome. And then when Tiberius was 3 years old, Augustus, the new emperor, gave his family a pass and granted them amnesty, and they were able to come back out of hiding. They actually went to Greece after Sicily, so they were kicking it in Greece at this point.
And so when Tiberius and his folks come back to Rome, Caesar Augustus, who was being advertised as the first true emperor of Rome at the time, he notices the family. Like, clearly he likes them a bit because he allowed them to return. But it's a little bit sleazy because he's super into Tiberius's mom, Livia. As a matter of fact, he forces Tiberius's dad to give up the marriage in 38 BC, and he marries Livia, and this makes Tiberius one of the emperor's adopted kids. So all of a sudden, he is going from like running to Sicily, running to Greece on the lam, to being the son of the emperor. So he gets all the bells and whistles that emperors get. His education is much better than a lot of other, you know, a lot of other people at the time his age. He learns philosophy, rhetoric, battle strategy. He gets, like, every day with the emperor is like a bring your kid to work day, because Augustus is like, hey, Tiberius, come with me to this parade. I want you to see how everybody loves me and how afraid they are. And, you know, one day, maybe this will happen to you, little buddy.
Oh, absolutely. And it was destined to be so. He really took a keen interest in those battle strategy lessons, which is definitely not something like the plebs would have access to. It was very much a package of education that was groomed specifically for a young ruler to be. And he exhibited a lot of cunning in military affairs, and he fought in Gaul and really made a reputation for himself as a military man. And he started into a career of public service, I guess you could call it. I've always found Roman leaders to not be in particular service to the public. A lot of it is very self-serving and self-aggrandizing, but we'll call it civic career, right? And so he initially was kind of a friend of the people. He defended and prosecuted at court, which was, you know, with an audience in front of the Senate. And he began to kind of make some changes that were geared towards sort of helping the common citizens. He reorganized the supply chain of grain and was able to kind of solve some problems with the way slaves were kept, which is not something that a ruler would typically like concern themselves with. Apparently, in the slave barracks, there were really poor conditions, and free people were being detained there, and draft dodgers were often trying to pose as slaves, which is interesting. And he put a stop to all that, and he really started to ramp up his career as a politician. What did we say it was again, Ben? Quaestor? Quaestor, que triste. He became a quaestor, a praetor, and ultimately a consul at a very, very ripe young age, and was given a tribune to oversee for a period of 5 years. And this is a great resource on thoughtco.com that gives us some nice background we're using on Tiberius.
I'd like to also give a shout out to historycollection.co, which talks about the rule of Tiberius. Now, you know, there are a lot of circumstances that lead him to become emperor. And I don't know about you all, but I'd like to get to the good juicy stuff with his reign. So let me just give you what they call the high level download in corporate America.
Give it to us.
Yeah, I'm shaved and I'm wearing a suit jacket, so I feel like it's on brand to say that now. So he is now kind of in line for the throne. Maybe he's fourth in line, maybe he's fifth, but at that point, he doesn't have a real good chance of becoming emperor in normal times. However, these are not normal times. Several people die, and every time someone dies, he moves a little bit closer to the throne, to ascending to emperor. And it's weird because eventually it becomes clear that Caesar Augustus was grooming another person to take over as emperor. But this person, Agrippa, dies when he's 50 years old. And so after a couple of other deaths, eventually Caesar Augusta has to go to Tiberius and, you know, officially adopt him to make him next in line for the throne with the following phrase, not especially a loving father's phrase. He says, "This I do for reasons of state."
Oof. "And I love you, my new son." Or what is it? New grandson? Nephew. Yeah, that's right.
He didn't add any of that. Yeah.
No, he really didn't. I'm just trying to help the young lad out. Because obviously, I don't know, maybe it was him not feeling loved enough that caused him to become the monster that we will soon describe him to have become. He was given tribunician powers for 10 years then and adopted his nephew, Germanicus, to be his heir.
So now he is he's riding high, right? And he kind of just has to wait for his weirdly distant stepfather to die, or adoptive father. He goes off and he still fights battles because that's what he liked doing. He's campaigning in what is modern day Germany. He's knocking down rebellions. He's shoring up the borders of the empire. Now, like, as the emperor is getting closer to death, he is getting more and more legal, constitutional power that puts him on par with the emperor.
That's right.
When Augustus dies, August 19th, 14 AD, They read his will. It confirms that Tiberius is the emperor, and it all becomes official September 18th, just a few days later, 14 AD. And at first, he's coming. He's like a sheriff in a Wild West film. He's coming to clean this town up. And he hates astrologers. That's my favorite part.
It is pretty funny. Yeah, but he had already kind of exhibited some of that stuff with the whole, like, you know, helping with the grain distribution so people could be fed and, you know, helping, you know, clear up conditions for the slave quarters and all of that stuff. That's not like the most magnanimous thing in the whole world, but the fact is he demonstrated that he kind of cared about normal people. So he apparently had a real burning hatred for sycophants, which is a word that I love because it just is fun to say. And obviously, that is a thing that a lot of these kinds of rulers are surrounded by. And he had no time for that. So he did not surround himself with yes men. He was very much in control of his own decisions. And he really tried to check some of these just gross abuses and mishandling of funds that had caused, you know, the lives of normal citizens to be really disrupted in favor of, you know, rulers living high on the hog. As we know, there were Egyptian connections with Rome because of Mark Antony and Cleopatra specifically. And so there were all of these kind of little cells, I guess, these Egyptian cults and also Jewish cults in Rome. And he disbanded those, likely with a very heavy hand. And he also, like you said, Ben, he banished all of the astrologers because he found them to be tricksters and not trustworthy. He consolidated the government, the praetorians, to make it more efficient. He quashed all of these riots and infighting, and he abolished something called the right of sanctuary, which I guess there's parallels in kind of modern day geopolitics. But what do you take that to mean, Ben?
So the right of sanctuary is this old concept. Of course, maybe, you know, it was kind of new at the time then. The idea is that if you're being persecuted by your own country, you can be protected by some other authority. Like, that's why you have all those things from the Middle Ages or films that are set in the Middle Ages where someone's like, sanctuary, sanctuary. It dates back to this concept. I do want to say, when we say Egyptian and Jewish cults, that's not a pejorative term. They are occulted, you know, they're practicing things in secret. So he saw them as an avenue. They have potential to be seditious. My last question with that one is, did the astrologers see it coming? Is that rude to ask? I don't think they saw it coming.
I highly doubt it myself, Ben. And so then, you know, he was seen as being kind of progressive, you know, in terms of some of the laws and the policies that he enacted, and seemed to be kind of helping the nation. Well, it was Rome, the empire. That's the word. Helping strengthen their navy. He stopped gladiator events, which obviously were hugely popular, and I'm sure that didn't go over particularly well. But as we know, I mean, it's an absolutely barbaric situation where slaves and, you know, prisoners are forced to fight to the death for the amusement of the people, and also mainly the hierarchy. And he even, like, eschewed this idea of having a month named after him. So he seemed to have a little bit of humility. He was not into extravagance and all the trappings of the office. So started off kind of strong, right?
Yeah. Also, good, I will say objectively, good call in stopping gladiatorial things. There were animals that were hunted to the state of critical endangerment. I'm just pro animals, anti gladiators, I guess. Yeah, this seems set. Like, he's clearly authoritarian. He's clearly trying to stop what he sees as hedonism, right? This all changes. In AD 23, his beloved son, Drusus, dies. According to contemporary reports and reports that, were written long after his reign, this is seen as his tipping point. There's a source called Cassius Dio who says Tiberius now became increasingly paranoid and bloodthirsty and cruel, and he was showing some signs of what we would call cognitive dissonance today. He would torture slaves to death, and then he would mourn people who died after he ordered their deaths, but then he would resent the people who he didn't purge This, like, imagine what a minefield that is, because it sounds like he's having some dithering, some indecision. He's like, man, I should have killed Kaster number two. Why are you alive, number one? I knew it was you. You've committed some weird crime. This is clearly going to have some blowback. He becomes incredibly unpopular with the Senate, who are the people he has to please, and with the people, like the actual people of the Roman Empire.
Absolutely. I mean, because he's definitely going after some wealthy landholders and people that are very influential with members of the Senate. He's just doling out all of these really harsh punishments and confiscating people's property. And then he just kind of ups and leaves in 26 CE. He's like, peace out, you know, I'm gone. And he takes off to Capri. It reminds me of that part in The Sword and the Stone where Merlin's like, blow me to Bermuda, you know, and then he's out and he's gone and he just pieces out to Bermuda and then kind of comes back at the end to sort of like set things right or whatever, or at least let Arthur come into his own. That is not what happens with Tiberius. So he goes to the island of Capri, which is a beautiful place. It's still a very swanky destination for the rich and powerful today. But he completely became like this hermit, and he assigned control to Lucius Aelius Sejanus, who is the captain of his Praetorian Guard. And he gave him this name, Socius Laborum, which means partner of my labors, which I guess is sort of like the idea of, oh, what would you call that, Ben? Like, what do you call someone that kind of rules in while someone else is maybe not doing well or like under the weather, like health wise?
Yeah, power behind the throne. You could also say
a regent, perhaps.
Regent yeah. is perfect. Yeah.
That's the one I was trying to think of. Yeah.
So Tiberius, when he does this, he seems to completely withdraw. I like that you bring up the phrase hermit. He is a recluse. He's in the island of Capri, Bay of Naples. But this is where it gets weird. So younger listeners, family listeners, be warned, this might not be appropriate for everybody. According to a source named Suetonius, who is also kind of like a TMZ, kind of questionable coverage.
Sure.
Yeah. Tiberius went nuts in the worst way and became an example of a lot of the things that he originally fought against. Here is an excerpt from Suetonius's Life of Tiberius, and all the he's refer to Tiberius here. On retiring to Capri, he devised a pleasance for his secret orgies, teams of wantons of both sexes, selected as experts in deviant intercourse, and here's my favorite part, dubbed analyst.
I first read that analysts, and now I realize that is not what it means at all.
We're like 9 years old. That's such a weird word. Anyway, so they said they copulated before him in triple unions to excite his flagging passions. This is a long quote. You want to help out with this part?
Yeah. It's better. And now this is referring to, by the way, he built all these villas, and the most elaborate of them was called Villa Jovis, which I believe translates to the Villa of Jupiter, which was an absurdly ostentatious palatial kind of estate on the island of Capri's northeast corner. It goes on to say, in referring to the bedrooms of Villa Jovis, they were furnished with the most salacious paintings and sculptures, as well as with an erotic library, in case a performer should need an illustration of what was required. Then, in Capri's woods and groves, he arranged a number of nooks of venery, where boys and girls got up as pans and nymphs, solicited outside bowers and grottos. People openly called this the Old Goat's Garden, punning on the island's name because the Romans referred to Capri as Goat Island.
It's so gross. Because, all right, well, our path is set. Let's keep going. You know, of course, we know that Pan, the satyr, is the Greek god with the bottom half of a goat and, I don't know, he's got the hindquarters of a goat and he's got the horns. And these were thought to be, you know, symbolically, they were representations of physical desire, of sexual passion. And so this is something that Suetonius is definitely leveraging to make Tiberius seem like a super horny old man. But this is one of the weirdest ones. So he completely is not doing his job as emperor.
No.
Instead, according to this story, he is getting so weird and specific with his pursuits that he's doing things that probably wouldn't occur to most people in the world at the time. Who else would have thought of training children, little boys, to act as nipping minnows, or what he called tiddlers, I believe, to chase him when he went swimming?
Yeah.
That's gross.
It's beyond gross. And just to take it one step further, they were nipping minnows because he would be swimming, I'm imagining, in the nude, and they would swim after him, nibbling between his legs. No one from the court was allowed to visit him on Capri. He was in complete quarantine, self-imposed, with this harem of young boys and women and girls and just having a good old time. There were even, local fishermen who were in that region. They were not allowed to fish in the waters of Capri. If they were found to be doing that, they would have hell to pay.
Yeah. And he turned the place into his own deranged pleasure island. So how did he get away with this for so long? He was distracting the Senate, which is something a lot of Greek and Roman emperors did, the whole bread and circuses vibes. He was distracting the public by his clearly deteriorating mental state, his sexual deviancy, by building statues all over the city and distributing all this propaganda, right? And he was so busy, though, with his weird fetishistic stuff that he did not notice the same person he was trying to keep in power was, of course, plotting against him. And then when he figured out that treason was in the air, he presumably put some clothes on,
right?
Maybe dried himself off, took off whatever weird costume he had on, and he said, "I've got to go to Rome.
Get ye to Rome." And he did that in AD 31. He summoned Sejanus, who was his buddy up until this point, to a Senate meeting, immediately condemned him to death, accused him of treason. And it's not like they tried him or anything. They just, the accusation alone was all it took, and had him executed along with anyone that was associated with him or his plot to overtake Tiberius as the ruler. And then, that wasn't enough. He, that paranoia that we described earlier, this is really coming into play because he goes on an absolute murder frenzy. And Tacitus, who's another historian, describes it as such. This is wild. Executions were now a stimulus to his fury, and he ordered the death of all who were lying in prison under accusation of complicity with Sejanus. There lay singly or in heaps the unnumbered dead of every age and sex. The illustrious with the obscure, kinsfolk and friends were not allowed to be near them, to weep over them, or even to gaze on them too long.
And so Tiberius really shoots himself in the foot here, way before the invention of firearms, obviously. You see, Sejanus, the person who was doing all the work and the person he supported and then the person who turned against him that he later executed, Sejanus had been taking the brunt of public blame for the emperor's weird, disturbing excesses. But when he was gone, when he was killed and out of the picture, the blame for this rested solely with the guy who was responsible, Tiberius. The empire continued to run on. It's a huge machine. But for the remaining 6 years of Tiberius's life, he was terrorizing Rome. The Senate, which was famous for infighting and betrayal and subterfuge, the Senate was scrambling, just like any congressional body or parliament, to agree on something. They needed to name a successor. And then Tiberius at this point is so far gone, he's convinced not only has Sejanus betrayed him or was planning to overthrow him, but he thinks Sejanus killed his kid as well. And so he sends out these spies, like you had mentioned in that quote. No one is safe. Even people who are on Capri are not safe. He's sending folks out for them. And eventually, just like his adoptive father, he takes an L And he says, I'm going to have to name some successor. So I'm going to name one of my adopted grandsons. He names his grandson Caligula successor. Mm. And then he says, I am nursing a viper in Rome's bosom.
Ha-ha! Fun, right? And then, you know, he gets into like an accident during kind of a ceremonial joust, I guess is what you could call it. And that really caused his health to take a turn for the worse. He fell into a coma, and the physicians that attended to him, you know, said he's a goner. He's going to be dead within like a day or so. Caligula's called for, the Praetorian Guard bend the knee to him, and the Senate officially proclaims Caligula to be the supreme emperor of Rome. You think they added the supreme just to give it a little more of a flex?
Yeah, you got a flex on him. But wait, there's a womp womp moment here. This is a very Larry David moment because Tiberius doesn't die. He wakes up and he's like, boy, I'm hungry. Cook me up something to eat. People are panicking. You know, this guy, now we can't have two emperors. That's not how emperors work. So history sometimes, very rare times, it turns on the actions of a single individual, which should be inspiring and terrifying in equal parts. One person changes the course of history. The new captain of the Praetorian Guard, Macro, which is a cool name, Macro slips into Tiberius's chambers. Again, he probably would have survived for a few more years. And he smothers the elderly former emperor to death.
Yeah, with a pile of blankets, which is kind of a step up from the usual hospital bed pillow smothering. But it's interesting, Ben, you know, you got to think, too, that this was in many ways a kind of self-preservation move on Macro's part, because he knew that if Tiberius found out that he and his entire guard had already sworn fealty to, to Caligula while he lay there in a coma, he would not have been very happy about that. And with his crazy rages, probably would have done something bonkers, like had them all killed or removed or imprisoned or something, right?
Yeah, that's a really good point. You know, regicide is a great crime, the killing of a king or a royal. But the more I think about it, maybe Macro was trying to save the empire because, you know, at this point, Caligula is clearly depraved, right? He doesn't have the track record of insanity that Tiberius has before he dies under that pile of blankets at the age of 77. So maybe Macro deserves more credit as in terms of his intentions. What do you think?
I think you might be right. He chose the lesser of the two nutcases in this particular situation because Caligula still hadn't had access to all of the resources that you do when you become the supreme emperor. So if you guys have ever seen the purely pornographic film Caligula starring Malcolm McDowell, which I believe was produced by a porn impresario, it was Penthouse because Hustler was Larry Flint. I believe it was the publisher of Penthouse magazine. And that is a film to check out. It is absolutely depraved. And some of the set pieces are nuts. There's one where he's taking out all his enemies and rivals by burying them up to their neck in sand. And then there's this crazy, like, giant thresher lawnmower type machine that, like, slices all their heads off, like their little cabbages above the ground, and it just lops them off. Don't know how historically accurate that is, but definitely a film worth checking out if you want something completely trashy.
Oh, I do want to add, so this is the depraved reign, the debauched reign of Tiberius, but we do want to add, I think I teased this at the top of the episode.
Oh yeah, I know what you're getting at.
Yeah, these stories are red meat, right? They're juicy, they're fascinating, but they might not be 100% true, because you might be thinking, fellow Ridiculous Historians, when you're listening to this episode, you might be thinking, wow, what gives with all these perverted, bizarre, depraved emperors in the Roman Empire? well, some of these might be tabloid stories. We have to take them with a grain of salt. We have to remember that a lot of these people who wrote these histories of emperors after they died, they were living under the rule of another emperor. And so it's not the best move to be like, you know who was way cool? That guy before you. You know,
yeah, and you got to think like, yeah, they're trying to curry favor directly, but also they know which side their bread is buttered on, and they may well have been slipped some of these details and said, "You will write of Tiberius that he had young catamites swimming after his bits and behaving as tiny minnows," you know, in a mm-hmm. orgy-esque, you know, situation on Capri. So you know, that sounds so bonkers that it's just crazy enough to have literally been made up by somebody. Because it's like, if I had to make up something just completely untrue and that would get people's imagination spinning, that might be a go-to.
Yeah, as someone who is recovering from doing massive amounts of improv back in the day, that sounds like a setup that you arrive at when a bunch of people are just brainstorming and they're like, what's even weirder? No. Now, this kind of depraved sexual behavior is disturbing, but let's get weird with it. Let's throw a pool in there, right? Somebody yes and me on this one. That's almost how it reads, because you'll see other reports that say Tiberius actually, when he lived in exile on Capri, he just lived with like a small group of people that were his friends or entourage, and he hung out and talked philosophy with Greek intellectuals. So the real truth is probably somewhere in between.
There's also an account from Edward Togo Salmon that says only 52 people were actually accused of treason throughout his entire reign, and that only about half of them were executed, and only 4 innocent men died, apparently. And here's the thing, you know, the system of government is really more to blame. You know, even as crazy as a ruler can be, it's the system of government that's kind of what empowers them to get that crazy, whether it's the Senate or whether it's just, you know, the nature of an empire in the Roman system, and that it wasn't merit-based at all, that it was all about succession. And so you would get these, like, you know, it's the same with royalty. I mean, you end up with these like completely underprepared and potentially mentally ill rulers because nobody has a choice but to elevate them to that position because they are in line.
Yeah. On various other shows, I've made my opinions about monarchical systems known. We don't need to go into them today, other than to say I am 100% on the same page with you.
Even in our system, you have a big problem a lot on stuff that it wants you to know about nepotism and about, like, you know, dynasties, political dynasties, which is kind of a modern version of this same kind of business in a lot of ways.
Yes. Yeah. All right. I'll say it. I'll keep it brief. This is not going to be a TED talk. But do you know how weird it is to explain to my friends who are not from the States, when they say, oh, okay, so this is a democracy, republic, a meritocracy, that means that the most qualified person gets the job. And I'm like, yep, that's what it means. Every few years, we elect the best and brightest of all 323 million something of us. And then they always hit me with that question. If that's true, how come so many presidents have had the same last name? How come they've been in the same family? I thought you said it wasn't a monarchy. At which point I'm like, oh man, well, you know, there's a lot lost in the chasm between theory and practice. Anyway, let me show you this landmark. It's called Stone Mountain.
Oof. Yeah. The fact they haven't sandblasted that baby yet is kind of lost on me. But, you know, history, you got to preserve history and all that. And speaking of preserving history, if you want to take a pleasure cruise to the island of Capri, you can do so from Naples and check it out. And the ruins, I guess, of the villa where Tiberius supposedly carried out all of these debauched activities is tourable. It's a bit of a walk. I think it's a couple of kilometers from where you get dropped off, but it's accessible and probably a very interesting hike.
And in conclusion, we hope you enjoyed today's episode, folks. We do have to say, to be fair, that while clearly we're having fun taking, in my mind, 100% valid pot shots at the problems with Roman government and the empire in general, they are in a large part responsible for some incredibly profound scientific and cultural and philosophical advances that remain important in the world today. So I feel like we have to say it, but still, Tiberius, it makes you wonder what leaders can get away with, you know? Not to say there aren't leaders who are bawling out in very strange, depraved ways today. Kim Jong-un, the Sultan of Brunei.
Donald Trump.
A lot of ruling members of the House of Saud in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. History is not as far gone nor as distant as I think we would like to think sometimes. So maybe Tiberius is a lesson that applies in the modern day. Maybe we could just call it, hey, don't hire your nephew. I don't know.
Absolutely not. Especially you're like, oops, you know, like Damien from The Omen type nephew, you know? No, that just read the signs, read the room. Not a good idea. But man, I got to say, Ben, as upsetting in some ways and depraved as this episode was, I really enjoyed talking about this with you.
Yeah, agreed. I'm also grateful that we have instituted our own form of government for Ridiculous History early on. I cannot remember if we were talking about this on air or if we were at a happy hour at a bar back when people went outside, but there was a time where we decided to elect Casey as our ruler. I think you're the only man for the job. Casey, are you okay with this? Heavy weighs the head that wears the crown.
I don't feel like I'm really cut out for ruling, but if it's thrust upon me, I guess I'll do what I can.
Oh, we be thrusting. It is thrust upon you. And, you know, in pure Tiberian style.
Oh, boy.
Thrusting on Casey, which can we start calling you the K-Store?
Sure. I love that.
K-Store Casey? K-Store on the case? Okay, I'm going to stop.
We'll get there. We'll workshop it. Thank you, as always, for tuning in. Thanks, of course, to our research associate, Gabe Luzier, who I know...
We're always saying, yeah, on the books.
It's on the books, though, now. It is actually happening. Gabe, thank you for penciling us in. I think we're such fanboys of this guy. I hope it's not too awkward.
No. Can we tease this a little bit? Saying that we're going to talk about psychedelic cats.
Mm-hmm. Nobody Google that. Don't ruin this for us or yourself. It's going to be a wild ride. And of course, thanks to our good pal, Christopher Hasiotis, due for a return appearance. I would say also Eve's Jeffcoat. I forgot to write back to Jonathan Strickland, aka the Quister. That one's on me.
What do you mean write back? We don't communicate with him in advance of his appearances. He just kind of materializes.
I like to write him some kind of like personal digs and insults because I think it
just to get his dander up.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. For sure. Huge thanks to Alex Williams, who composed our theme. Thanks to super producer Casey Pegram, K-Store Casey on the Casey case. How about that?
There we go. Yeah. And thanks, of course, to our good friend of the show and personal friend, Sarah Kotanoff, who initially tipped us off about that write-up. And Noel, as always, thanks to you.
Yeah, thanks to you too, Ben. And just really quickly, thanks to Justine Good, who wrote that nice list for Vanity Fair and thought to include us. It means the world. We'll see you next time, folks. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.